ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः। नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमपि शचीपुत्रमत्र स्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरुपुरीं माथुरीं गोष्ठवतीं राधाकुण्डं गिरिवरमहो राधिका माधवाशं प्राप्तो यस्य प्रतितः कृपया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वन्देहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयतः परकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणरघुनतन्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपादान् सहगणललिता शिवशाखान्विता। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। Well, I'd said that the discussion, I'd completed what I wanted to discuss about attitude in pilgrimage. There's more. Gokul Chandra Prabhu suggested that I also go through the 10 offenses to the holy dham. I've always been a little wary about these because I'm not able to ascertain if they're shastric source, if there is any. And many of them seem to be modeled on the 10 offenses against the holy name. But anyway, they are offenses, and there are certain offenses, and although this list might not be directly from Shastra, nevertheless it's worth taking note of. So here they are. I'll just read through. I won't comment much on them. Number one, to show contempt or disrespect for the Guru who reveals Vrindavan Dham. So of course that's very much like Guru Ravagya, the third offense against the chanting of the holy names. Number two, to think that Vrindavan Dham is temporary, to think that it's part of this material world. Number three, to commit violence toward any of the Vrajavasis, the residents of Vrindavan, or the pilgrims, or to think that they are ordinary people. Number four, to perform mundane activities while living in Vrindavan Dham. Exactly what's meant by that is not clear, because presumably one has to pass stool and urine, one can't avoid that. So number five gives some clue to that. Earning money by and making a business of deity worship and Harinam. Well, that's not exactly, it's a masquerade of spiritual activities. Number six, to think that Vrindavan Dham belongs to a mundane country or province like Uttar Pradesh. Well, clearly from the earthly perspective, Vrindavan Dham at the present time is part of Uttar Pradesh, that part of land which is known as UP. Even before it was constituted as a state, it was called UP also, United Provinces. But one should know that although from worldly perspectives, it appears to be part of Uttar Pradesh. And for all intents and purposes, we deal with it like that. We get a train to Mathura and then a tonga or a taxi or whatever to Vrindavan. The devotees who are overseeing the affairs of ISKCON in Vrindavan, they have to interact with the local municipal authorities who are under the government of Uttar Pradesh. So in one sense it is, but we shouldn't think that Vrindavan Dham is just another place in Uttar Pradesh, such as, well, actually many of them are holy places also, aren't they? Like Prayagraj, Mathura is also holy place, Varanasi, holy place. Let's think of some place. They probably all have some connection with some saint or avatar, but at least some places like Ghaziabad and Meerut, they're not known to be holy places per se. They're ordinary places in Uttar Pradesh. They are in Uttar Pradesh, right? They're not in Haryana. They're near the border. Part of number six, to equate Vrindavan Dham with a holy place of the demigods. So that's important. If you think that we go to a Shiva Kshetra, Kedarnath, for instance, and if we think that, well, going to Vrindavan, going to Kedarnath, it's the same because Shiva and Vishnu are the same. If we think like that, that's also an offense. To attempt to measure the area of Vraja, well, that's a funny one, isn't it? Because we talk about the Charasi, Krosh, Mathura, Mandal. We're invited to join Parikrama. But again, the understanding should be that although we can in one sense measure it, and in another, in one sense all the sampradayas, they recognize that it's Chaurasi Krosh, 84 Krosh. What's a Krosh in English measurements? I don't know. But on the other hand, we understand that Vrindavan is unlimited. Number seven, to commit sinful acts while residing in Vrindavan Dham. That's an intensification of performing mundane activities in Vrindavan Dham. Sinful, what is sinful in one place is offensive in Vrindavan. If one sins by, for instance, unnecessarily and not according to the laws of Shastra, killing an animal in some place, that's sinful, but it becomes an offense in Vrindavan. There's a fine line of demarcation between sin and offense. Maybe I'll discuss that in another talk. Number eight, to consider Vrindavan and Navadvip to be different. Number nine, to blaspheme the Shastras that glorify Vrindavan Dham, and 10, to be faithless and think that the glories of Vrindavan Dham are imaginary. So there they are. Could be expounded on more. I'm going to read a quote from Tamal Krishna Goswami in which he mentions about pilgrimage in the Indian tradition. And it's part of a description, just one paragraph, of the spiritual facilities which are available in Bharata, in India, and the spiritual atmosphere, the underpinnings, the spiritual underpinning of the culture. So this is from to Mahan Krishna Maharaj's writing. Indian people seem to take it for granted that a certain amount of austerity is not only unavoidable, but can actually be enjoyable. As small children, they are accustomed to accompanying their parents on long pilgrimages. Some of them are accustomed to that. And even in their daily lives, there are so many basic austerities dictated by their relatively simple lifestyle. Of course, Tamal Krishna Maharaj first came to India in the 1970s, and he was based here in India for 2 years or more, and traveled widely in that time throughout the land. And life was very, very simple, and people just took it for granted. Just like, for instance, one very common feature of Indian life, practically iconic in the sense that you see pictures of it in. It's a standard photo. If there are photo books of India or tourist brochures in the Western countries for India, seeing a group of women with pots on their heads because they have to go a distance to bring water, and they bring clay pots on their head. Nowadays in the cities, if there's not water tapped into the house, in each colony there'll be a tap where water comes for a certain amount of time each day, usually not very long, and then the women get there with their plastic pots, not clay or brass anymore, and they line up, and sometimes they fight each other. I put my pot there, it's part of Indian culture at the present time. So that was just taken for granted. That's one of the women's duties, to collect water. Even they might have to go a long distance in some areas, some dry areas. For instance, in Rajasthan or Saurashtra, in this season, the hot season, they might have to go a long way. But even normally, they may have to go some distance to collect water. So they just take that for granted. And no electricity, so you feel the heat. If there's no fan, and there's no doctor, so when you get sick, well, there are local people who cover up as doctors. A lot of sickness, yeah? And people just take it for granted. What the Western devotees coming to India found to be tremendous austerities was just normal for people living in India. It's changed now. And people, especially the comfortable middle class, growing up in the cities, they have all kinds of facilities. And they can't even sit on the floor cross-legged, many of them. They sit at tables and chairs. Completely unnecessary. Unnecessarily taking up space. You just told me the other day someone came from Bangalore and some rich party, some donor. You showed them all the temple construction. They're very impressed. But they're more impressed when they saw the little huts that we live in. What are they, 10 feet by 10 feet? Something like that, which is pretty small. And particularly, they said, where's the furniture? Where's the beds? Oh, we don't have beds. We sleep on the front. Oh, very impressed. I really don't see what made much. It doesn't make much difference whether you're sleeping on a bed or sleeping on the floor. When you're asleep, it's all the same. And it's not like we're sleeping on a bed of thorns. But somehow they're very impressed by that. But I remember also so many devotees in the 1970s would come to India, and they just couldn't take the heat, and then constant disease and digestive problems, don't like the food. And in this season, in the hot season, which goes on for months and months and months, there are rashes and digestive problems and mosquitoes at night and flies in the day. And I've seen devotees literally on, actually two of them who were with me in Bangladesh, literally on the verge of a nervous breakdown. It was just too much for them. I mean, that's dealing with the people and this and that. It's just, but what from that comfortable Western lifestyle is considered very austere, that was just normal. They just took it as normal. That's all. So that's an advantage for spiritual life, because bhogaishvarya prasaktanam tayaparita chetasam vyavasayatmako buddhya samadho navidhiyate. One cannot progress on the path of spiritual advancement if one is strongly attached to material enjoyment and opulence. It doesn't mean that simply by being poor one is spiritually advanced, but some serious obstacles, one doesn't have them. Of course, the poor man can also be very greedy to get such things. But if his attention is pointed toward Krishna, then it can become an advantage. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Dinere adhik daya kare bhagavan kulin pandit dhani varo abhiman. Bhagavan tends to be more merciful to those who are poor or low, considered low in human society, because those who are proud by their high birth, their high learning and their wealth, yeah, they're proud, and then that's a disqualification in Krishna consciousness. So continuing reading from this quote from Tamal Krishna Goswami, spiritually, India is abundantly advantageous. And he's given one reason why, because of the basic austerities of day-to-day living. But there are others also, and he goes on to enumerate some of them. With her, India is abundantly, spiritually, India is abundantly advantageous with her numerous temples, sacred rivers, and places of pilgrimage. There are constant opportunities for hearing spiritual instruction, and such philosophical truths as reincarnation are common knowledge even for ordinary villagers. So 2 days ago in Hindi I was speaking about how we should be careful to avoid hearing Krishna katha from people who are speaking to promote themselves and their own prestige or an entertainment style. That is very widespread. If we really want to become fully surrendered to Krishna, then we have to hear Krishna katha spoken by people who have the same aspiration or who are situated in that position. But nevertheless, even Krishna katha, unless it's presented with a grossly wrong understanding, grossly offensively, then there are many points which will be absorbed by that. Even Mayavadi speaking Krishna Leela, at least people have heard of Krishna. Maybe finding something good in a dirty place, something like that. Whereas in the Western world, when Prabhupada went there, people hadn't heard of Krishna. Very few people had even heard the name of Krishna. And even Mayavadi is talking, well, at least people get some idea of reincarnation. There should be piety. I was just listening now to a narration of Srila Prabhupada, how the governor, I think it was, of Madras at the time, P. Patwari, had come to see Srila Prabhupada in Bombay. And this Patwari was promoted moral uprightness. So it's not only in India that people promote moral uprightness, but that will be nourished by hearing narrations of Mahabharata and Ramayana and various shastras which tell us that, for instance, that the soft breasts of someone else's wife may be very attractive, but they are the path to hell, things like this. So even such philosophical truths as reincarnation are common knowledge even for ordinary villagers. Srila Prabhupada also walking in Vrindavan once, morning walk, and a farmer came and ran down, fell down at Srila Prabhupada's feet and said, "I'm very fortunate that you are blessing my field by walking through it." And Prabhupada pointed out to his disciples that this is the difference between India and the West, that in the West, if you walk on someone's field, they might shoot you, actually. I had to experience something like that myself. We just stopped somewhere, and for some reason or other, driving in America, some open place, and then I was just walking up and down Chamaya Road, and someone comes up looking very disturbed, and told me I own this place. It's just some open field. And he said, "Well, anyway, you look like peaceful, so okay." Whereas in India, they don't see you as a trespasser, a holy person. "I am very fortunate that you're blessing my field by walking on it." And so Prabhupada pointed out that even big scholars, and he always gave the example of Professor Kotovsky in Moscow, they don't understand, or they don't accept, even if it's explained to them, that we're not the body, we're going from body to body to body. Whereas even a big professor in the West doesn't understand this, but a simple, illiterate villager in India does. So that's the spiritual advantage of India. So continuing reading from Tamal Krishna Goswami, "The vestiges of culture still remaining from Vedic times create a nourishing atmosphere for executing Krishna consciousness." Now he's talking about himself and other Westerners in India, Western devotees. "One felt little inclined, nor was there much time, to dwell on thoughts of sense gratification." Another reading, this time this is from Giriraj Maharaj's still in preparation, soon to be published book called "I'll Build You a Temple," narrating Srila Prabhupada's struggle to make a palace for Radha Rasa Bihari in Bombay, and many other related topics also he describes in that book. Giriraj Maharaj, he kindly allowed me to preview it. So I'm going to read from this. This is describing Srila Prabhupada at Kumbh Mela in 1977. Must be, yeah. Prabhupada said that he too wanted to bathe in the Triveni, the confluence of three rivers, the Ganga, Yamuna, and Saraswati, but he did not want to go into the crowd. So at his request, two devotees went at the most auspicious hour, managed to reach the river's confluence, managed to reach because there are huge crowds. And all of them want to reach that, all of them want to go to that small area. And there are literally millions of people trying to get to that small area at a specific time. And it's a great feat of management of the UP government and the police that they manage generally to keep it orderly. And everyone does get to bathe during this specific period. So anyway, the devotees went down at that time early in the morning and returned with a bucket of water so that Srila Prabhupada could bathe with it the following morning. When Prabhupada gave darshan the next morning, everyone wanted to know how his bath had been, that specific time when the nectar is pouring down. That's the nectar from the that was acquired by the gods in the fight between the gods and the devas and the asuras, and that amrit, some drops fall down at that time. If you bathe in the Triveni, that Triveni at that time, then you get liberation. Prabhupada thought for a moment and said that it was like any bath in any water from the tap. It wasn't that Prabhupada had... Prabhupada was already millions of times over what anyone bathing in the Triveni gets, fully in love of Krishna. So, Giriraj Maharaj continues, even though many millions of people went to the Triveni during Kumbh Mela to take their auspicious bath, Srila Prabhupada explained, any service that anyone did anywhere in the world for the pleasure of Krishna was more auspicious. Then you may wonder why Prabhupada went to Kumbh Mela at all. Well, that he explained. He said, we're not coming here to get liberation. We're already liberated. We're coming here to preach. In this regard, I'll read something more from Giriraj Maharaj's book about Srila Prabhupada at Kumbh Mela in 1977. Even movie, radio and television people were there along with the usual newspaper reporters. Everyone wanted to hear Prabhupada. All the reporters had the same question. What is the significance of Kumbh Mela? You may wonder why they're asking. And I thought about this and I thought that, well, actually at that time, things like Kumbh Mela were going on and people were going on pilgrimage visiting different places, but hardly anyone knew any reason why they were doing it. No one propagated it. You couldn't look it up on the internet, obviously. And people would just go, but often they wouldn't know much about why they were going there. They had some vague idea, you get liberation. How, why, the story of the fight between the demigods and the demons for the nectar, and they didn't know. Nowadays, quite likely due to Srila Prabhupada's efforts to educate, although if we are to be objective, there were others also who started educating Hindus about their culture. There were others also who are doing that. Chinmayananda, for instance, dedicated his life to teaching people jnana from the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, his understanding of Bhagavad Gita wasn't according to the Vaishnava parampara. But anyway, there's nowadays, the people, they want to know. And there are people explaining, either properly or improperly or whatever. But it was a very common thing from my memories of the 1970s in India, that Hindus would refer to empty rituals, and there are all these rituals and no one knows why you do it. They wanted some scientific explanation and so on and so on and so on. They didn't believe in the mythology, as they called it. So what is the significance of Kumbh Mela? Prabhupada answered that the heart of the Mela was Sadhu Sangha. Not the bathing, Sadhu Sangha. That it was meant to bring the common man in touch with saintly persons. He explained that there were three types of transcendentalists who were after either Brahman, Paramatma or Bhagavan, and that Kumbh Mela was the one time when all types of transcendentalists came together to give ordinary people a chance to get their association. Sadhu Sangha, Sarva Siddhi Hoy. By even a moment's association with the Sadhu, one can attain all success. And of course, towering over all the others, the sadhus there was Srila Prabhupada. And even many of the press people and the TV, they appreciated that because they came to see Srila Prabhupada. And even many sadhus there who in their own minds and in the minds of others and even according to Shastric understanding were spiritually advanced, they could have benefited tremendously from Srila Prabhupada's association. I'll read one more anecdote from Giriraj Maharaj's book about Kumbh Mela. This is an incident that took place after Srila Prabhupada had left, and even after most of the pilgrims had left, because the main bathing day was over, and Kumbh Mela continues, but not so many people stay. It's 1 month. And on the major bathing days, so many people come, and the rest of the time, not so many people are there. So he had stayed, Giriraj Maharaj had stayed behind with some of the other devotees to help pack up the camp and do whatever is required. Oh. Yeah, okay. So it was not after everyone had left. He describes that later in the book. So he's describing on the last big bathing day, because the mela, the fair, goes on for 1 month, but there are, I believe, three major bathing days, and then after the particular days which are most auspicious for bathing. So on the last big bathing day, an incident took place that I thought illustrated the Vedic culture of the festival's participants. It was cold and rainy, and we needed a rickshaw or taxi to go from the camp to the city, but we couldn't find any. Hundreds and thousands of people had already left and taken all the transportation. We walked in the mist for a few miles until we saw a lone rickshaw by the side of the road. It appeared empty. Rickshaw in those days meant there's two big wheels and a thing in the middle and two poles, and someone runs along pulling it or walks. And when you say rickshaw nowadays, you think, that's what rickshaw meant. And then when the roads in some places got a little better, then they had cycle rickshaws and then auto rickshaws. But rickshaw in those days meant it required a human being to physically pull it along. It appeared empty, but when we looked closer, we saw the driver hiding underneath, sleeping. We woke him and told him we had to go to Allahabad, but he refused to take us. We offered to pay double the price, but he said, "No, it's raining and I'm feeling tired." Presumably they had with them someone who spoke Hindi, because presumably the rickshaw wala didn't speak English. Even when we offered 10 times the price, he refused. That's a lot, 10 times the price. I mean, rickshaw wallas, they don't earn much money for all their hard work. Even though they work all day, they have to pay for they don't own the rickshaws mostly. He told us that at 3 o'clock in the morning, he had walked for many miles in the cold rain to take bath in the Triveni. Huge crowds had been pushing and shoving, but he had tolerated everything for the sake of a dip at that auspicious moment. And then Giriraj Maharaj's comment, "I couldn't help but admire the man. For mukti, he was ready to do great tapasya, but he couldn't be bothered for the sake of earning money." So there you go. I'll finish there for now. Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Vancha kalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya vichapatita nam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namah.